Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we will return to a subject that we've discussed at least a little bit on this program over the years, and that is nanotechnology. And we'll talk about some of the work that's being done in this emerging field, very rapidly growing and emerging field here at the University of Illinois. Certainly, there are people who believe that nanotechnology, and indeed it is a broad and diverse field, is something that has great potential to change the way we live in our daily lives. Certainly it has great potential to change our economy. And this morning, in this hour of the show, we have two guests with us. Irfan Ahmad, he is the Associate Director at the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology here at the U of I. And also Rashid Bashir, he's Professor of Engineering and is Director of the Micro and Nanotechnology Laboratory at the U of I. Part of the reason for doing the show is just to make sure that people know that once again, the nanotech folks on the campus will be doing a workshop. That's happening the end of this week, the 4th and the 5th, taking place at the Beckman Institute and the Micro and Nanotech Laboratory at the U of I. And one of the things that will be going on as part of this will, in fact, be the formal dedication of the recently expanded Micro and Nanotechnology Laboratory, which is at 208 North Wright in Urbana. That was the work was completed earlier this year, and so now they're going to have an official ribbon cutting. We'll talk a little bit about that lab and also about nanotech work here at the U of I. And people who are listening, you're certainly welcome to call with questions. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much, both of you, for being here. We appreciate it. Whenever we do this subject, I always wonder just how, for people who are listening, what they know about nanotechnology, or even when they hear the word, what they think about. And I expect that probably people do have the idea that what we're talking about is something that's small. Okay. We've got that. But past that, I guess I always think, well, I'm not really sure what people know about nanotech. And so I'm thinking, well, maybe one way we could start is if I could ask each of you to perhaps give an example, and it maybe could be drawn from your particular fields of some development in nanotechnology that's new and exciting and revolutionary. And I don't know who would like to start.
Go ahead and start.
Professor Bashir, why don't you start?
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting us again. It's a great opportunity to be able to present what we're doing and also highlight our events tomorrow and DEF tomorrow. So nanotechnology is really the basic definition is nanotechnology is the engineering of sort of systems, functional systems at a very, very small scale. Mm-hmm. It is different than chemistry where people do work at a small scale, very small molecules. It is different than only biology, where many biological organisms are very small. But nanotechnology refers to the ability to be able to engineer systems at that scale. A nanometer is 10 to the power of minus 9 meter, which is a billionth of a meter. And just to give you a perspective, a virus might be in the range of about 100 nanometers, which is 0.1 micron, but let's say 100 nanometers, that's the size of a virus, plus minus. 1,000 nanometer would be about the size of a bacteria. Mm-hmm. And if you go 10,000 nanometers, that's the size of a cell that's, let's say, floating in our body, in the blood, for example. Just another perspective on the scale would also be in today's modern computer chips and the microprocessors or the memory chips that you get from Intel or Motorola or AMD, the minimum feature size is now less than 100 nanometers. It's typically in the order of few tens of nanometers is the minimum scale that can be defined. So it's things that are at that scale that are very small and that require our ability to sort of engineer them. Traditionally, nanotechnology, sort of from the very inception of it, it was the definition implied more designing things from what we call the bottoms up. So starting from the bottoms up and being able to design and synthesize systems. That's sort of the goal. That was the original hope and goal of nanotechnology. Over the years, certainly. The definition has expanded a bit in some ways because traditional forms of semiconductor and electronic manufacturing has scaled down, and we call that top-down nanotechnology now, or top-down fabrication, where you're trying to make things smaller and smaller. So this example that I gave earlier of a microprocessor or a computer chip, the fundamental unit element in that that has shrunk over the years through Moore's law. Gordon Moore was the CEO of Intel at one time. And so the idea that now in computer chips you can find features that are well below 100 nanometers, and that also has reached the regime of nanotechnology. Mm-hmm. So it's really a merger of this bottoms-up, top-down, and also being able to integrate chemical synthesis processes, biological processes, and biological entities such as DNA and proteins, and kind of merge them to be able to design systems at that scale.
Right. Professor Armand, give us an example.
So like DNA would be a 2 to 3 nanometer, and so some of the faculty researchers are like engaged in developing nanopores, which will help sequence the DNA. And one thing it is not, and it's just a general understanding, is that anything which is small is nanotechnology. And the example that cites comes to my mind is that there are satellites out there which are 1 foot by 1 foot, and people call them nanosatellites. And so that's not what nanotechnology is, but it's so. And the venture capitalists generally, they again jokingly say, is that anything which gets you money under the nanotechnology is nanotechnology. But at the end of the day, the stricter definition, what Rashid alluded to, is ranging from 1 nanometer to 100 nanometer range. It's a length scale, or a thickness scale. And then there are right now carbon nanotubes, which are around 2 to 3 nanometer, and this those are developed and are currently being used in tennis rackets, and to make them stronger and lighter, and similarly other areas. And and then there are, of course, nanoparticles, which are being used also for as transport mechanism for drug delivery. And other areas.
So it has very wide applications. In fact, right now, maybe I don't know if people realize it, but there are in fact many consumer products that are on the market right now that use nanotechnology. Things that, and I don't know if even people know that they may have some of these things. Maybe they're not completely aware that nanotechnology, one way or another, gets involved. Everything from tennis rackets, do you say, to fabrics that resist right. stains, and I don't even know. There are, in fact, I know places on the web where you could go and you could see a list of all of the various products,
right.
and there are medical devices, and there are things that are involved in agriculture, and there are things that are involved in electronics, all sorts of things that use nanotechnology right now.
Yeah, I think latest numbers looking at about 300 products out there which are nano-based products. Either the process itself is at the nanoscale and or the final product is at the nanoscale. And so some of that may include your abrasion-free sunglasses, your towels, and then there are products out there like self-cleaning windows and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Is what you were talking about here manufacturing something that is unique, that did not exist in nature before? Is it that dramatic?
So I think in some cases, yes, that is the case, that people discovered ways to synthesize different elements, like, for example, carbon nanotube was one example, mm-hmm. or the buckyball, which is a specific form of carbon. Technique was developed to synthesize it, and then it was discovered that these materials have, you know, tremendously exciting properties. They are very strong. They conduct electricity at different, rates than other materials. So yeah, it is talking about new materials that can be synthesized or that have been synthesized, mm-hmm. That allow us new functionalities. And nanotechnology, really, I think you need to really think of it as an enabling technology that actually cuts across a wide spectrum of applications and industries. So in the area of electronics, in the area of materials, in the area of health and wellness, in the area of agriculture. So there's lots of applications and a lot of application domains. It's really an enabling technology that really cuts across.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of these areas are now seeing applications and products that are coming out. And certainly there's a lot of exciting things to be done in each one of these areas.
I would think that there probably was a time when before when people were thinking about working on the nanoscale before they could actually do it. They were thinking about, wouldn't it be great if we could manipulate matter at that level, but that they couldn't yet because they didn't have the right tools. What had to happen? What sort of things had to be, other technologies had to be in place before you could go from the idea of nanotechnology to actually realizing it?
Yeah. So that's an excellent question. The original ideas of what we call nanotechnology can actually be traced back to Richard Feynman, Professor Richard Feynman, who's a professor at Caltech, who gave a very famous lecture, and that can be found. People can Google that. And the title of the article is "There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom." And that's now quoted as really as one of the sort of original papers in the area. Which there is no word nanotechnology in that paper, but it talks about all of these ideas of being able to do things at a very small scale at the atomic level that really were not possible at that time. And then the term nanotechnology was, I think, invented sort of or talked about by Drexler in the 80s. But I think the one thing that – the one technological innovation that enabled the field forward was the invention of the scanning tunneling microscope and subsequently the atomic force microscope, which allowed people to scan and observe, quote-unquote, features at the nanoscale. You really couldn't image things at that scale before. Hmm. So the atomic force microscope and the scanning tunneling microscope in the late 80s, that was really probably one of the key characterization and metrology technology that had to be developed before people could move further.
So you had to – one thing you actually – obviously you had to be able to actually see what you were doing
exactly.
on a very small scale. But then at the same time, I suppose you also have to have – don't you have to have nano tools in a sense if you're going to build something on the nanoscale? It's like you have to have nano wrenches and nano pliers and nano screwdrivers. I'm being flippant, but in a sense, I suppose you actually do have to have nanoscale tools.
Well, in some cases you do, and in some cases what people have done is, very, very clever scientists and engineers have developed tools and technologies that use synthesis processes and chemical synthesis processes that were adapted from existing processes, but mm-hmm. they now had the precision of fabricating structures at that scale. And in some cases, new manufacturing tools had to be developed to be able to synthesize and to be able to order structure at that scale.
Hmm. So this, based on that, there was a center which came out of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technologies putting together these multidisciplinary teams in terms of developing these manufacturing tools that you alluded to. And so there's a center now on campus funded by the NSF, which is in a second cycle, and it's called the Center for Electrical Mechanical Manufacturing Systems. Mm-hmm. And so they are tasked to actually develop some of these tools because some of the traditional factories that we have cannot take this as it is and make into a production line the product. And so there were a couple of these centers which were given out by the NSF in 2003, and now they are moving in those direction, making tool beds and e-jet sprays and other manufacturing tools which will help facilitate some of the applications that we are talking about today.
Yeah. Well, let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in. Irfan Ahmad is the Associate Director of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology here at the U of I. And Rashid Bashir, he's Professor of Engineering and also Director of the Micro and Nanotechnology Laboratory at the University of Illinois, formally being dedicated here this week. And part of the reason that we are here talking this morning is so that they can have the opportunity to talk a little bit about this year's 2008 nanotechnology workshop. Now, how many years now have you been doing this?
So, as you may also recall, because we have been in sync, and so since 2003, that was the first time we put together a workshop, and it was at that time day-long activity, and the focus was industry, and that was the first time we did. And backtracking a little bit, I mean, the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology is a campus-initiated center with support from the campus administration and from the College of Engineering. And the whole idea of this putting this center together was to help develop multidisciplinary teams and go after large-scale funding and center-level grants. And so we have been fairly successful with that in terms of bringing the center that we mentioned about the manufacturing Manufacturing Center, and then another one on the Siteman Cancer Nanotechnology Center, funded by the National Cancer Institute in association with Washington University in St. Louis. And then more recently, the not a center, but a project-level engagement in, from the USAID on, again, using nanomedicine for cancer research. So those are those activities then have featured in each of these workshops and subsequently, which have led actually because being a large campus that we are here, and we, I mean, according to last estimate, I mean, about 150 researchers engage in micro/nanotechnology on this campus, covering about 10 colleges, 30 departments. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty significant as compared to our other peer institutions because we have a traditional strengths in College of Engineering, and nanoelectronics and photonics, but then we have other strengths in College of Agriculture and College of Veterinary Medicine, and even in liberal arts and sciences, where chemistry and chemical and biomolecular engineering departments are housed, and then several others looking at the societal implications of these in law and social sciences, and including applied health sciences. So all of these are being brought together under this kind of a framework, so which has given the opportunity for the different faculty, researchers, and graduate students to seek the large-scale grants. So one of the last proposal that we wrote was on Center for Environmental Implications of Nanotechnology. So again, it transcends the different areas, and again, it's a big concern about how the nanoparticles will be have a life cycle and how they will be handled in the air, and are there any drastic outcomes of these or not? And so those discussions have to be on the table. Mm-hmm. And so this center then has enabled those sort of discussions to take place. Then take it to the next level in helping them write centers and then produce, train the graduate students to do that and also help develop devices. And one of the latest interest or focus of the campus and the college itself has been to conduct translational technology. A socially responsible engineering. So basically not only have an eye to what you're doing, but to an eye to what it is going to help with or solve a problem and an issue with. And so like water is one issue, clean drinking water is one issue, healthcare is another issue, energy is another one, environment is other. So those are the sort of the discussions and the focus that we bring about through these centers in actually achieving that.
Yeah. And what now the new laboratory, the expansion of the laboratory, what does that give you an opportunity to do that you were not doing before or couldn't do before?
So the newly expanded micro nanotechnology laboratory was funded by the state through an $18 million grant from the state, and that expansion was completed earlier this year. This really essentially doubles the space that we had for faculty offices and graduate students and also research labs, and it will allow us to really bring what we really would like to do is bring faculty from across campus, from different disciplines, to come and work together towards this area of nanotechnology, because it's a very, very interdisciplinary field. As Irfan mentioned, there is expertise across campus in engineering, in sciences, and people are collaborating. So this facility then allows us to actually have more people housed within this building, independent of sort of any one home department. Mm. The building also has the largest clean room on campus. It has an 8,000 square foot clean room, which actually has all of the manufacturing equipment to be able to fabricate, silicon and compound semiconductor materials for photonics, for electronics, and for MEMS, which is micro-electromechanical systems. We have also now added actually a new bio-nanotechnology laboratory. Bio-nanotechnology is sort of this interface of nanotechnology with biotechnology, or applying nanotechnology for biomedical applications. So we use the terms nanomedicine and bio-nanotechnology. So we've set up a lab, a 3,000-square-foot space lab, which is a shared user facility with equipment that was actually funded by the Air Force to be able to bring people together and do work in bio-nanotechnology. And their examples include, sensors for detection of diseases, chip-based sensors, diagnostic devices that could tell you very rapidly presence of cancer markers or presence of different disease markers in body fluids, implantable devices that could, circuits and devices that could be implanted in the body for real-time detection of disease and then transmission of the information outside the body. So things along that line. We'll have that capability to really push that further to the next level.
Yeah. Well, we have a couple of callers, and I want to bring them into the conversation. Also, I just thought that I would mention that if you were interested in finding out more about the center and what they do, they have a nice website, so the easiest thing for you to do would be to go to their website, which would be www.CNST, so that stands for Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology, CNST.UIUC.edu, and you can find out about, you certainly found out about the conference, but you can also find out about other the various kinds of research projects that are going on. We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that, starting with Champaign County and line one. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Quite a cooperative interview. I hope this isn't too discordant, but in the realm of the social dimensions of the research, I'm wondering whether you have any provision for is called European, the precautionary principle, the idea that something introduced should be not just assumed to be safe, but some diligence should be done to show that it's safe. It's kind of an irony that the one incident that I know of a nano product being having some bad effects was in Germany, where a product that was used to spray on the inside of your shower stall to, again, to stop things from sticking, actually had some bad effects on a number of different people there and was taken off the market. But so there's that. I do have a question that is related to the technology and the possible technologies, and I think it was in Feynman lectures where I first learned about quantum tunneling, and I'm wondering whether he speculated that when you're getting down into those ranges that you could see those kind of effects, and whether people are is that an avenue of research that people are looking into? And I don't want everything to look like an answer to the energy problem, but when you can actually sort of short-circuit the law of thermodynamics, you do have a possibility of doing things that are that would be seem like a violation of same. So I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Those are both excellent points. Let me just address the first one quickly. I think the environmental impact or the potential health hazard impact of nanotechnology is critical. Clearly, as these products get deployed, I think that's something that absolutely needs to be done. And actually, there is a lot of emphasis from the funding agencies, from NSF, NIH, to further understand that and to continue to understand that, enhance our understanding in that. Many of these nanoparticles or nanotubes are very small, so they can actually be taken up by they can penetrate cell membranes and cell walls, so cell membranes specifically. So that's very important. And as Irfan mentioned earlier, there's actually a specific call for NSF that came out last year to specifically look at the environmental impact of nanotechnology. As these things, if you manufacture them and they end up getting released in the environment, what will happen and things like that. And obviously, right now, none of that happens as much as we can control it. All of these things are done in a very controlled environment with the utmost care to the operator and the user as and to the students and researchers as they're working in this area. But that's a very important point, and I think it's something that we're going to have to keep thinking about and keep diligently working on to understand the biological and the environmental impacts of nanotechnology. Mm-hmm. To answer the second one, yeah, that's a very good question. Also, I think there's lots of interesting possibilities. Feynman did, in that article, from what I recall, mention that. I think it really hasn't been demonstrated yet, as far as I know, but I don't have the exact answer to that. But I think the ability to be able to, again, manipulate matter at that scale allows lots of very interesting possibilities. Let me give you another example that's not related to what the caller said, but using materials at that scale and how you order materials at the nanoscale, you can produce what's called negative refractive index materials, where light can actually not return back to your eye, but rather be absorbed, so objects could appear invisible, for example. So people are working on cloaking devices where you could make metamaterials, they're called, that could be possibly classified within the realm of nanotechnology, because there are ways to make metamaterials with nanostructured materials. So that's another example of where you can certainly use properties of materials at that scale to change laws, or not to change laws, but rather discover new things that we couldn't think of before.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the caller raising the issue of environmental impact. That certainly was something that I was planning on doing if nobody did. So what if you were indeed, you say you have produced a novel substance, something that did not exist before, and there is obviously this concern. Well, what possible environmental or health impact might it have? What do you do And is there a standard sort of procedure that one follows to determine whether that's safe and before it gets released in the environment, or are you relying on researchers to do due diligence first and that it's up to them to decide whether or not something would be safe? I mean, how exactly does that happen?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of both. And actually, that's where certainly when you're talking about developing something that ends up in the hand of the consumers, I mean, I think our government and here in the U.S., we are very, very particular about that. So I think the FDA and the regulatory approvals, all that's all sort of an evolving process at this point, because certainly the nanoproducts that go in that direction, you know, have to be carefully evaluated. You have to do toxicological studies. You have to do studies in how these particles you have to do first studies in animals and then move it up to humans. So there's actually a pretty rigorous process. I do have to say it's in some ways it established, but in some ways it is probably still evolving, because as new products are brought to bear, the regulatory agencies are also sort of battling with this and working together, essentially, with the researchers to be able to develop those methodologies.
Yeah. So I'm sure that one of the concerns people would have, say, if you point to the way that pharmaceutical products are developed, the people who are doing the testing are the ones who are developing the products, and they it's not like they have detached, they have no interest. They have the interest. So then I suppose some people would say, well, should we indeed be trusting the person or the entity or whoever it is that's developing the product to also be the ones to tell us whether or not they think that it's safe?
Let me refer back to the caller's comments alluding to here in the U.S. As compared with the U.K., U.K. has, or Europe has, much more stringent environmental standards. And that's why even the nanotechnology related the environmental implications the standards have been developed and are being implemented, as compared to the evolving standards that and the discussion that is going on here in this country, yes, there is a strong need, and the reason that some of us when we go on air is exactly to bring the public into this discussion, and we do not generally would like to see same attitude which was accorded to biotechnology because of not creating enough awareness among people using genetically modified crops and non-genetically modified crops, and even in some of the nations who were in dire need of food would refuse to take those. And so public awareness is one key aspect of when new technologies are being developed. And so this is our endeavor in actually going about doing these things and making the public and their discussion come into play. Then there are several studies which have come about on the role of nanoparticles on animal health and so on and so forth, or in rat and fish and the like. And then some of the naysayers have also alluded to, is nanotubes the next asbestos? And so that's, those are discussions which definitely we should have, and the researchers should be engaged in. One of the recommendations or suggestion I would say on the table is that each time a researcher is engaged in those kind of research activities, there has to be some attention paid towards how do we look at the environmental implication of that, and then to help develop standards for that. There are now the faculty members at several campuses in law schools looking at standardization of it. And the National Institute of Science and Standards and the NIST the technology actually they are engaged in those sort of discussions, and including prodding from the NSF and the NIH.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Irfan Ahmad. He is the Associate Director at the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology here at the U of I. He's also on the faculty of Agricultural and Biological Engineering. Rashid Bashir is an engineer as well. He's also Director of the Micro and Nanotechnology Laboratory at the U of I. We're talking some about some of the research that has been going on here for a number of years on nanotechnology here on the campus of the University of Illinois. They're holding their annual nanotechnology workshop for 2018. and 8 later this week, September 4th and 5th. That's taking place at the Beckman Institute and also the Micro and Nanotechnology Laboratory on the U of I campus, which is having its formal dedication as well this week. If you're interested in finding out more about the center, about some of the things they do, again, as I mentioned, you go to their website, which is www.cnst.uiuc.edu. We have another caller here to talk with. Let's do that in Belgium, not too far away. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Good morning. Mm-hmm. Just to start with, I would highly suggest, Mr. Inge, that a program on Dr. Feynman would be very interesting to all, I'm sure. He's a very, very interesting person. But to get to a question I have for your guest, I noticed that when we talk of nanotechnology, that it seems to be almost exclusively involved with carbon. Is there nanotechnology in other elements, or is it pretty much based in carbon?
Well,
so I can answer that. Yeah. No, definitely nanotechnology, carbon and carbon nanotubes is really one example, and probably the most talked about example, like you said. But there's many other materials that are used when we talk about nanotechnological devices and materials. Gold nanoparticles, for example, are used as imaging modalities for looking at specific disease markers. Cadmium selenide quantum dots. So for example, the mixture of cadmium and selenium. Like I said, gold is one. Silicon, of course, also. So it is. Carbon is just one of the materials that is used. There is actually many, many more materials. Of course, a lot of the polymers, a lot of like hydrogels and materials that are hydrocarbons, essentially, also. So it's really a lot more than just carbon.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You have a question, you can certainly call in. Elements behave in particular characteristic ways, and they do certain things. They behave certain ways under certain conditions. They like certain of them, like to combine with certain of others of them. When, though, you're talking about working on the nano scale, do you find, and I know what the answer is to the question, I know what the question is, yes. You find it, were you working at the nanoscale, that different properties emerge, that is, these same things, could be carbon, could be gold, whatever, actually start to behave differently?
Yes. So I think, differently meaning that the unique combinations of these elements at this size scale of, let's say, between 1 to 100 nanometers, new properties can emerge, which maybe are not, observable or measurable at the larger scale, at the micro scale and larger, or at the, atomic scale, so to speak. So it's really that range of between 1 to 100 nanometer is which, we all believe that there is a lot of exciting things that nanotechnology can help us offer. So for example, material strengths could be different and could be significantly highlighted. When you're talking about the tensile strength of a particular material, what it takes to break it. If you were to look at its properties at that nanoscale, if you could structure it at the nanoscale and then layer it together, for example, it's the resulting net properties of that micro or macro scale materials might be different than if it was synthesized differently. So I think it's a matter of ordering, matter of synthesis at that scale and being able to control things at the scale that could result in different properties.
Well, here, forgive me, not being a scientist, that this is all a little difficult for me. I guess my question would be, is if it's possible to manufacture something at the nanoscale in a way that doesn't exist in nature. Why doesn't it exist in nature? If it can exist, why doesn't it?
So that's a very good question also. I think in some cases, things that have evolved in nature, let's say biological entities and molecules and life, they have evolved over lots and lots and lots of years. So, I think in this case, we're talking about sort of an integration of different types of molecules and different types of materials, or rearrangement of let's say, the structure of a specific type of material that existed. So, I think the reason some of those things don't exist in nature yet, just because nature has had, millions of years.
I certainly take your point about that. If we're talking about living systems. I guess I was thinking about
hybrid systems.
Things that are not alive. Right. You know, material, not living materials, but things that exist, combinations of things that exist in a certain way. And so the question was, well, if they exist in this way and they can exist in a different way, well,
why don't they?
I mean, why do we have to tweak things so that they would work in that different way? Perhaps there simply is just no answer. It's just, well, that's just the way it is.
Yeah, in some cases, again, that's the whole point of sort of engineering these materials, mm-hmm. or engineering new concepts. I mean, these, you know, you can think of individual materials as building blocks, and then we can use our creativity to think of new things that we can develop as we integrate them together, as we combine them together, which don't exist. Mm-hmm. So I think as scientists and engineers, we are trying to sort of create new things that don't exist that can help people at large.
Sometimes also nanotechnology, some refer to as atomic technology. So that means your ability to manipulate atoms at that level and place them in ways and forms from bottom-up approach. And that then drastically alters their characteristics. And so that we've gotten that ability because of the recent development of the tools which enabled us to do that. And previously that was not possible. And just like as Rajit mentioned a little while ago, that the scanning tunneling microscope and the atomic force microscope and all the other instruments which have been developed over the years have enabled us to be able to do that at the atom level, mm-hmm. and so which has given us the ability to make new materials, nanocomposite materials, lighter. I mean, so now there are nanocomposite materials being used in aircrafts and so on and so forth. And so with an eye to the energy savings and so on and so forth, a lot of the bumpers on the cars and so on and so forth, and all the pedestals have these nanocomposite materials and or nano coatings so that they are abrasion proof and so on and so forth, including some discussion on using it for ag equipment and during the plowing and tilling of a mobile plow or a disc plow. And so you have that so it becomes abrasion proof.
All right. Let's talk with someone else here in Champaign. This is line one. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
The previous caller, I guess, or two callers ago, asked if there were other kinds of molecules that were involved in nanotechnology. A couple of years ago, I lost the epidermal layer of my lower leg, so my whole half of my lower leg was just laid bare. And the wound center people put a sheet of silver nanocrystals on that. And it was the doctors were just amazed, even though they were the ones who did it. They were really surprised at how quickly my skin grew back. So there's an application, and they told me they were nanocrystals of silver. And so there's a neat application of nanotechnology, I think, in the medical field that I found rather interesting. To this day, I don't know why that would work rather than some silver ointment, but they put silver ointment on it originally, and nothing really happened. And then when I went to the wound center, they gave me this sheet. It's called Actikote, and it was really quite amazing. And I'll wait for your comment.
All right. Well,
in wound healing and artificial skin is now out there among some of the applications which have been developed under the nanomedicine category. And then there are discussions of these are discussions conceptual standing of like you have a surgical gloves which have fluidic capability, so you can do a triage in the field and so on and so forth, and so you'll be able to take your pressures, and your surgical glove actually is a sensor itself, and so some of it may sound like science fiction, but now you could see that there's light at the end of the tunnel. You can see that these things are possible. I mean, right from an early article that we wrote on Honey, I Shrunk the World, this was a movie made a long time ago. At that time, it was considered a science fiction, but now you could see that. I mean, so you have these particles which could go and sit next to a diseased cell and release the drug. at the time and at the amounts that needed. So it's like, so to speak, some would characterize that as a nanosurgeon. So you would have it go at the level and without affecting the rest of the cells, healthy cells around it.
So if I can just add to that. So I think, yeah, the medical applications of nanotechnology are certainly very, very exciting, and there's a lot of work going on at UI campus on that. Just one example, as mentioned earlier, I can expand briefly, is the idea of DNA sequencing. You know, if you can take a single molecule of DNA and actually sequence it very quickly, very rapidly, at a very low cost, that could really dramatically change everything around us in terms of how healthcare is managed and how diseases are treated. So that's an example. And there really how nanotechnology comes into the picture is that DNA is a nanoscale molecule. It's a very small molecule. And nanotechnology fabrication methods and manufacturing techniques have now allowed us to make sensors that could be at the same size scale as single molecule of DNA. So you can take one molecule of DNA and possibly sequence it. That's a goal. It hasn't been yet accomplished, but that's a goal. So that's one example. The idea of making disposable sensors where you could really, this idea of personalized health management and personalized health care, if you could, you know, today you can monitor your blood sugar level with these sensors. That's just one example of sensing. You could have so much more that could be done if you can really look for different, disease markers or different metabolites or different ions in the body and do that at a sort of a continuous scale, rate. And that can be enabled by using microfluidics and nanosensors integrated into chips, for example. And that's the kind of work that we're doing now at the Micro Nanotechnology Lab also.
And those are all things that might sound fanciful, but you would say, oh, that's perfectly doable. We just have to figure out how to do it, but there's no reason why we should not be able to do that.
That's right, exactly. I think it's all possible in the near future.
Mm-hmm. But again, I mean, since especially when we address issues related to the human body and injecting materials into the human body, there are a number of issues which can come into play. And one is, of course, the healthcare issues, and then the legal issues and the legal ramifications of that. All of this has to be thoroughly deliberated and discussed and awareness created about it when you're doing. With any new technology, we are going into uncharted waters. I mean, and be it your cell phones, be it whatever. Now we have started discovering what are some of the pitfalls of having the cameras in the cell phones and so on and so forth. But there are advantages also. So with any technology, there's the pros and the cons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there, one of the things you have mentioned a couple of times is the idea of manufacturing at the nano level. Is there indeed a lot of work being done manufacturing materials where literally you're stacking one atom on top of another atom, actually at that scale?
So there are examples of things at that scale, but certainly what I would say is that those technologies are not mass-produced to that level. If you, however, look at the semiconductor manufacturing technology, like I was saying earlier in the show, the minimum unit size is barely tens of nanometers. And in that case, at least at a two-dimensional level, people are depositing layers of atoms in a very controlled fashion through a process called atomic layer deposition, which is used in mass manufacturing. So there you are putting, at least in two dimensions, layers of atoms by atoms to be able to control them very precisely, and putting a total of 15 to 20 layers of atoms of silicon dioxide or aluminum oxide in two dimensions at least. So yeah, some of that is going on. And in some cases, people are still working on developing the technology. Like was mentioned earlier, there's an NSF center here that's working on developing the technology to be able to further advance those nanomanufacturing techniques.
Mm-hmm. So like nanoparticles are available now and people can buy it in grams and so on. And they order it, they use it in their research labs. Similarly, the researcher here in physics produces the silicon nanoparticles and shown interest. One of the things that sometimes the craft food has done is actually coat these with what they call nanojet sprays, and so that your aroma of your food is retained. And so when you open it, it will give you a delayed release of aroma. So meals ready to eat and those sort of things, and also from those being used in the battlefield with the troops and so on and so forth. I mean, those technologies can really enhance some of the some of the outcomes of this. Hmm.
I think something that we've talked about in the past that I've thought has been interesting is various kinds of filtration technologies for water purification. For other sorts of decontamination, if you're talking about you want to screen out something that's very small, well, you got to have a screen that's got very small holes in it.
Features, yeah.
And that, in fact, one of the things that you could do with this technology is indeed build filters with very small pores and, I suppose, custom made to screen out particular sized particles, and that would be something that could be very useful in a wide variety of things, purifying water so people could drink it, dealing with pollution issues and so forth.
Yeah. And water, I mean, as mentioned earlier, is a key issue, and colleagues here are working, and there's another NSF center which is called the Water Campus, and actually they are engaged in those sort of exercise, including nanofiltration devices, where you would, I mean, say in this case, Giardia and Cryptosporidium, and these were some of the waterborne instances which happened actually several years ago in Wisconsin, where there were a couple of the deaths and sicknesses. Mm-hmm. And so those are of interest. And then, as you may know, the water itself is going to be the point of contention all over the world because of scarcity and also the availability of clean drinking water. And so any times you can use those techniques to clean water or desalination of water, or in disaster relief situations, like the UN was giving out these tablets in Burma when they had this tsunami or cyclone, they call it, and to clean the water for people to drink, to enable them to drink. And so water, in water specifically, I mean, these filtration devices, these the tablets and other methods which are being developed. Arsenic in Bangladesh is a big issue. And so these are challenges which are confronted in the developing countries. And that's where this relationship of developed nations helping developing countries and address these issues, and at the same time, I mean, making these water supplies available, that would be key, because water, as we also know, it also results in healthcare issues like diarrhea and waterborne diseases and so on and so forth. And if you do not have a clean drinking water, then you magnify your healthcare issues.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting you mentioned desalination, that is taking the salt out of water, something that now is it's very expensive and very energy intensive process that really, unless you have a lot of money at your disposal, it really makes it cost prohibitive. Mm-hmm. And of course, then there are also issues about once you've taken the salt out of the water, what do you do with that? But there is real potential for using this, and would this be a more cost-effective way of taking the salt out of water?
Well, I mean, that's a possibility. I mean, this is more geared towards where there is no the fresh water supplies. I mean, like the Middle East, and so there's a big plant in UAE. For desalination. What kind of technologies can be used there? I mean, those are subject to discussion, but I'm saying that there's a potential for all of this to be of help or to facilitate those.
But certainly, as you say, that there is many places there are serious issues with various kind of contaminants, either biological or chemical contaminants in the water. So we're looking at ways of getting those, either the bugs out or getting whatever kind of or minerals or chemicals, problematic chemicals that would be in the water, get them out of there so that then
yes.
That water would be drinkable.
And nanotechnology can potentially help with that. Exactly. That's the bottom line.
We're coming down to the point where we maybe have a couple of minutes left, and I don't know what if there are some other things that you'd still like to touch on.
Yeah, I'd like to just also mention about the symposium and the dedication that we're going on tomorrow. So we're just tremendously excited and thrilled about what's happening tomorrow. In the morning in the Beckman Center, we have our keynote sessions, and we actually have the director of NSF and the deputy director of DARPA coming to give keynote talks. This is part of the dedication event. In the afternoon, actually at 11:30, we welcome everybody to come. There is actually a ribbon-cutting ceremony at the Micro Nanotechnology Lab. And I just wanted to briefly also talk about the lab itself, of course.
Sure.
I mean, the Micro Nanotechnology Lab, really we are tremendously proud of the accomplishments of the faculty from the MNTL and beyond and the campus in the area of nanotechnology. The lab itself is rooted really in the visionary work of two-time Nobel laureate John Bardeen, who came here in the 50s, and then Professor Nick Holinick, who is still a professor here and an active researcher in the Micro Nanotechnology Lab. So he's the inventor of the light-emitting diode, of the practical light-emitting diode. And so the strengths in photonics and electronics and integrated circuits, so from Bardeen to Holinick to C.T. Saw to Jack Kilby, who was an alum and the inventor of the integrated circuit, I mean, there's just tremendous contributions from UFI and from sort of the roots of MNTL, and we're just tremendously proud of that. And so really tomorrow's event is just to kind of celebrate our past and our history, and also just show our, you know, very strong enthusiasm about the future in these new areas where we're going to continue to work very hard to maintain our leadership position in photonics and circuits and electronics, and then also expand to newer areas like applications of nanotechnology in biology and medicine.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, so the, as Rashid mentioned, so the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology itself brings together these workshops and acts as a collaboratory, as a virtual center, bringing other centers which are engaged in nanotechnology research and package it and present it to the general public. At the same time, what we see is that all of these the strong traditions and history of excellence on this campus has resulted in these multi-million-dollar industry that we see, the LED industry, the plasma display, and the transistor that we see, or the integrated circuits and chips that we see are so prevalent and pervasive that we even don't recognize that, all emanating from the campus and from funding initially starting from the state. And so the state's funding actually have nurtured this environment with campus administrations, their vision over the years, leading to what we are today, and we are projecting it to the future.
Well, once again, just want to mention that the Nanotechnology Workshop 2008 will be happening on the U of I campus this week, September 4th and 5th, at the Beckman Institute and also at the Micro and Nanotechnology Laboratory, which is being officially formally dedicated. If you're interested in finding out more about nanotech research on this campus or about what's going to be happening as part of this conference, this workshop, you can easily go to the website of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology, www.cnst.uiuc.edu, and you can find out all about it. Our guests this morning, Rashid Bashir, he is the director of the Micro and Nanotech Lab at the U of I, and Irfan Ahmad is the associate director at the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology here at the University of Illinois. Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you very much.